Welcome to the Open Adoption Project. This is episode 102. We're the Nelsons. I'm Lynette.
And I'm Sean.
In this episode, Alicia Gallagher, who is our communications director here at Open Adoption Project, will be interviewing Christelle from episode 88.
This is a kind of a follow-up episode to an interview that Alicia did for us several months ago now. And we had a lot of just follow-up questions for her and were just curious about more aspects of her experience. So Alicia meets with Christelle in this episode and asks a lot of really kind of the tough questions about being an international transracial adoptee.
So Christelle, it's so nice to have you back on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me back. I'm excited.
Yeah, we talked about a lot of great topics last year, and there was just so much that we loved and wanted to follow up on because there just wasn't enough time to cover everything. So before our listeners who are meeting you for the first time, can you tell us a little bit about you, a little bit about your adoption story?
Sure. Well, I'm Christelle Pellecoeur. I am a coach and I specialize in supporting Black adult adoptees, helping them navigating their adoption story and their own identity. But I'm also a podcast host and a host of Black Adoptees Identities, and I interview Black adoptees about their own experience of their own adoption story. And on the side, when I have time, I'm also a multidisciplinary artist, so I do work around film, fashion, and writing. So that's me currently who I am. But my adoption story started in Madagascar, where I was born. My mother was very sick, so she ended up going to hospital, and she left me in the village in the Catholic missionary at the time. I am not very sure if that was a temporary arrangement, but things got worse and my mother passed away in hospital. And the next thing, I was put into an orphanage and then put for adoption in France at the age of 10. So into a white family. So it's kind of a transracial adoptee. So trying to navigate all different culture, different languages while growing up and in a tiny village in south of France where there was nobody who looked like me. So that's why kind of some of the challenges that I encountered with my adoption story.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we want to talk about. Just those tough questions that white parents who are considering adopting or fostering Black or brown children might encounter. I think there's a lot of worry around, I mean, first of all, there's more awareness, I think, around identity and the importance of it. And now all of the issues are being brought to the forefront of how little education has been done and how much more needs to be done so that those mistakes from the past aren't repeated. So I encourage listeners to go back and listen to our first episode with Christelle, but we'll just dive into a few follow-up questions that we had about your experience. I'm wondering if you can paint the picture for us of what it was like in your home in Madagascar and then moving to France, like the big differences that you noticed, I'm sure the culture shock that you experienced, just what everything looked like and sounded like. Can you just paint that picture to get us in the mindset of what it might be like for a young child?
Yes, of course. I mean, it was like day and night. It's everything was so different in Madagascar. I lived by the sea, it's that kind of careless childhood, running around by the sea all the time with my friends. And I lived in a very tiny village, fishing village. So that's kind of what my memory of my childhood is about, playing on the beach, living with my mother in the village. But also in terms of, everyday life, it was more about, even like the food, it's everything is based on rice and cow meat and, a lot of fruit like mango fruit and lychee. And, a lot of those things doesn't even exist in France. So that's in itself as a very big culture shock, and the language is very different. Although in Madagascar, the administrative language is French, but in the village where I was living, because it's very small, hardly anybody speaks French on a daily basis. If they had to go into the big city and deal with paperwork, then they would speak French. But on a daily basis, I wasn't speaking French. So I had to learn the language. And actually, when I was put into the missionary, the Catholic missionary, I was not allowed to even speak my own language anymore. Once I got there, I was told I had to speak French, so I had to learn. And my French wasn't very good at the time, so I had to start learning French on a daily basis from that time. And when I got to the orphanage, I was going to a French school. So very quickly, I actually lost my language. So yeah, I mean, and also I think one important thing that was very different for me is in terms of, because I was put into the Catholic missionary, it was very much based on religion. The prior to that, it's, you know, a lot of the things that I've learned, you know, was about African spirituality. So my grandparents will be dealing with everything around plant medicine, for example. So I've never learned about, you know, medication until I got to France. So things like that is very different in itself. So yeah, getting to France was a real culture shock, because even if I started learning French, I didn't actually understand very much by the time I got to France. And I also felt stuck because I was already been forbidden to speak my own language. So at that point, I couldn't even speak my own language, because I think that was part of the trauma. My brain just shut down about my own language. And yeah, I mean, I was surrounded living in a culture where I would see Black people every time. And actually, I've never questioned why we're all just Black in Madagascar. I think it was more when we see French people in Madagascar. And that's also, I mean, my adoption is very complex, because Madagascar was not independent from the French until 1960. And I was adopted in the 80s. So it's a 20 years difference. So that period was very complex in the history of between France and Madagascar. And that's partly why the missionary Catholic were in France, because they were trying to educate the local people.
I see.
So for me, France, white people was, I didn't see many white people growing up in Madagascar, just the random missionary in the village, and sometimes people coming to tourist visiting in the seaside village. So going into a mansion where majority of people were white, that was also quite a culture shock. But because suddenly it was a reverse situation, I was the minority. I didn't see anybody who looked like me around, and that automatically, I think, question like, oh, this is the first time I think I realized I was Black in a way. I was different to everybody else, I guess.
Yeah. Well,
Yeah.
the trauma of losing your language and the food and the sights and everything that made you who you were and what was home, and then instantly put into a place that is completely different.
Yeah.
I wonder what the if you could describe the home environment that you went into. So obviously, like you mentioned, your parents were white. Did you have siblings that were already living there? And just what it was like to step into a new household.
Yeah, so my adoptive parents were also foster parents. So the house was, there's lots of children. So they had two of their own biological children. And then they had, at the time, it varied, but I would say the average was about four, six children from foster services around the house. So it was always a very busy house. And I also had my mother's parents living downstairs from us. So it was a
A
very
lot
busy
of
house.
people. That's a
Yes.
lot of people. Did you know? Were you expecting that? Like, was it explained to you that it's going to be like it's a house full of people and you're getting right into this whole ecosystem?
Well, I got some pictures And the picture only showed my adoptive parents and their two biological children on the picture. So I wasn't expecting anybody else around. But also, even when I got the picture, I didn't understand what the meaning of all this. I didn't understand what adoption was. I didn't understand why I was going into this place. And for me, I think at the time when I was told, I didn't even realize how far it was from my own country. I didn't, I've got no idea as a child, not having left my village, how what that is. Only when I was in the plane and it was taking forever. I guess being on the plane, I think it was like 13 hours journey. So that's only when, but even going to the airport, that was a culture shock because our tradition in Madagascar, that girl always wear a dress or a skirt, and trousers is reserved for boys or men. And they put me into this tracksuit traveling in the plane. And even that, I couldn't compute. I didn't understand why am I wearing trousers? It's boys wear trousers. And even that, it was little things, but it was very difficult for me to understand because it wasn't something I was taught about. I wasn't taught about like, are we going into this very different culture? Things is going to be very different. I can't remember anybody telling me that. All I can remember is this picture of this family. But yeah, he didn't really compute in my mind what's happening.
Well, that's interesting because I think we talk a lot about adoption education for adoptive parents, but with older kids who are getting adopted, is there like educating the child who's about to be adopted about where they're going and being sensitive to the loss that they're experiencing? Because I think there, of course, there are a lot of infant adoptions and there's not as much explanation that can happen, but there's probably just as much adoption happening for older kids, that the education just isn't happening.
And I think the other in my household in France, what's I found difficult was is because my parents, because I was adopted for the Catholic missionary, so my family was very Catholic. And when I say very Catholic, they still are very Catholic today. And it was, praying every day. And that is something I never did. Like I said, my family was more into African spirituality, so it wasn't something that I was even educated about what Catholicism was. And it's things like having to go confess to someone. I couldn't understand why I had to go. It just for me it was reiterating things like I have done something bad that I have to go confess to someone else. And and that's I think has impacted the way of life as I was growing up, because I always have that guilt and shame having to go confess because I've done something wrong. That has been, I think, quite difficult to understand. But yeah, the family was loving, I had a lot of love but I think it's just a culture shock and not being prepared about what I was going into. And I think my family were not prepared either. I think, there's this idea about wanting to have a child. I think in the 80s and now, I think why people adopt might be very different. And I even think when I speak to my parents now, I think they're more apologetic about, they wanted to provide a good home and for a child, but they were not prepared about all the emotional side of the adoption. And also they were not educated about what trauma I might have had before coming to them. And I had a lot of trauma in itself because my mother passed away before I was even 9. And I didn't have any support or had time to grieve about that. There's things like an early drown when I was 5 or 6. And that is, even to this day, I love water, but I'm very scared of water at the same time. So there's things that, from my own history, that my parents were not even aware. So even, like they had a swimming pool, they couldn't understand, for example, that I wouldn't want to go swim for
Interesting.
times. And so it's just little things that, things that have happened in my past that my parents didn't know and I'm not prepared for. So, and I couldn't explain to them either why I didn't want to go swimming. It's internally I felt a fear, but I couldn't tell them, oh, this is the reason why. At the time, it didn't compute that, oh, I nearly drowned when I was this age, and that's why I'm scared. It
Yeah.
didn't, at that age, it didn't make the connection. So I couldn't even, verbalize it to them.
Right. Well, you're probably in survival mode. You're just processing all the new things that are happening in front of you, and you don't have time to ponder on the thing from the past that might be impacting the now because there's so much happening at the same time. Did you feel like it was, was there open communication between you and your parents about adoption? Were there conversations where they would talk about, how they came to the decision of adoption and intentionally trying to help you feel part of the family, even though everything is new? Like, what was the communication like about your adoption?
We didn't really have any communication about the adoption. And I think the environment where we were, because there's so many of us in the house, my parents are constantly trying to raise God knows how many children at the time. I don't think they had the time. On top of that, my dad was also working in his day job. So it wasn't, I don't think there's a space to be able to talk about it, but also I don't know. I think there was maybe some preconception from them that because they've had foster children for such a long time, it would be the same from an adopted child. But actually, sometimes it wasn't the same because most of the foster kids would go weekend to see their family or from time to time. I didn't have any of that. I, you know, as you know, adoption is a complete severance from your family. So in that sense, that separation is harder to accept, I suppose. But yeah, no, we never, and even now, in the last few years, we started to talk about it because I needed to know things about why they adopted and why they were not taken much more interest about my culture and I mean at the beginning when I was adopted and I also have a sister who has been adopted from Madagascar but we're not blood related and at the beginning when I was adopted the agency from where they adopted us would have like a yearly reunion so all the children that's been adopted through that agency would meet. And actually, the majority of them would have been from Madagascar, Ivory Coast, or India. So it was the one only dealing with international adoption. So at the beginning, I would see some of the people that were adopted at the same time as me. So there was that connection. But I left France when I was 18. I moved to the UK because I just felt that I wasn't fitting in that environment, and I don't know, I needed to just do something different. So I went to study in the UK when I left when I was 18. So I suppose that's kind of, I only spent 8 years in France, although I still got the accent, which I can't get rid of. But yeah, that's part of the assimilation of being assimilated to a language at early age and being forced to learn that language has been so imprinted in my DNA.
Yes. So I'm moving to the UK. I remember previously you talking about feeling like there are people like me here, and there's just more ability to freely express who you are and different, just more variety than you experienced in your home and in your neighborhood growing up. And growing up, so you had black siblings and white siblings, is that right?
Yeah.
What was that like? Like, did that feel significant to you? Because I feel like perception is such a big thing. You know, everybody is paying attention to everybody else, and some parents might feel self-conscious. They're out in public, and my family doesn't look exactly the same as all the other families because we have kids of different races. And you also describe growing up in a place that you were one of the only Black children in the area, right? And so did that feel significant? You're going out in public as a family, and are you like grappling with, you know, our family doesn't look exactly like all of these other families out here.
Yeah, I think it was all the time. I think my family were okay with it because, you know, they're the one making the decision to adopt children from a different country. And like I mentioned, I think at the time for the church there was a lot of, you know, the white savior behavior kind of I'm saving a child from their environment. So it was kind of, you know, I would see people would be like, oh, congratulations or well done for saving this child life kind of things, but it would automatically will be visible because you're not the same color, so people would see I am not a biological child. I think at school even children didn't understand it because every time I would say, oh, this is my mom or this is my dad or this is my sister, people would be like, you could see on their face that they couldn't understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
And I had that even in my teenage year.
that's such a good point, because when someone meets you, people are sort of filling in the, oh, this is what your family must look like, and then they meet you with your family, and all of a sudden it's almost like the hard thing that you've experienced in life, you have to, it's constantly there. Like people kind of see that by nature of you being with a family that doesn't look like you, something hard has happened in your life. And so I'm sure the wheels are turning, and like there's curiosity, but people don't want to overstep. Like, did you feel people try to grapple with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like I said, even in my teenage year, I mean, I had my mother's brother is about the same age as my sister, which is my parents' biological daughter. So when I used to go out when I was 18, I'm going, he was probably in his mid-20s. And I would say, oh, that's my uncle. And I think people get so surprised because I think they couldn't understand the age gap, first of
Yeah,
all,
right.
but also the color didn't like match. So it was very interesting. And even I think even when I had my daughters, I had my daughter very young. And I remember traveling with my cousin. So obviously he's a white male. And we have the same surname because I took over my adoptive parents' surname. So my daughter is look like me. My cousin doesn't look like me, but we've got the same name. And my daughter doesn't have the same surname because she's got a bad surname. And it was almost like people thought that I stole that child because, you know, and they thought I was traveling with my husband, first of all. You know, all those assumptions that we've got the same surname, that must be my husband and this child. So I had to always travel with so much paperwork to a letter from my daughter's dad to say she was allowed to travel because the French are so mad with their paperwork. And it was really crazy because I always have to prove at times that who I was traveling was my family member and not like my husband or whoever. And that was really awkward at the time.
Yeah, it's just always present, where maybe some adoptees can hide it or bury it and not have to talk about it. Even travel logistics, that you're having to process it constantly. It's a very present part of your life. What about like hair care, skin care? I know that if for parents who are not Black, raising Black children, hair care is so important. And you know, taking care of skin is so important. And it takes learning to figure out how to do it, and unless you grew up doing it. So what was that like, going from Madagascar, you're surrounded with people who can help you care for your hair, and then you're with white parents who, like, did they know? Were they ready for taking, like, helping you with your hair?
Yeah, no, I don't think my mother was ready. And I think it's harder for a child who's older because you don't have even the time to adjust yourself. At least when a baby, you've got time to learn and with
Yes.
the changes. But when a child is already older and have the hair already in a certain ways, I think it's harder. I mean, my mother was very good with the skincare. I would give that to her because she would always moisturize. She was very big on that. So I didn't really struggle with the skincare, but I've gone through so many different things with my hair. I had a period where I was straightening it because, again, everybody around me had straight hair. And so I wanted to look like everybody because I didn't want to stand out. So I would go through straightening and burning my scalp. And yeah, those were painful moments. Even like going to the village hairdresser and she would do perm on my hair because she wouldn't know anything
Oh
else.
my
And
gosh.
she was like, the experimentation of all the different things that I've tried, it was interesting until I managed to find, and I don't know, I can't remember at the time if I found it or if my mother found it, a black hairdresser in a couple of city further away from where we lived, who would braid my hair. And I think that saved my life quite a way finding them because, and then I would go like the whole day, Saturday's hairdresser for someone to braid my hair. But at least I was okay for a few weeks and I knew that they were not that far away, I could go back again. But I think the first 5 years was just experimentation.
Yeah, that is and at the time, there's not YouTube tutorials and things like that where she could sort of teach herself. So that's good that that experience happened. Did she stay with you? Because braiding takes a long time. Would she sit in there with you or like drop you off? And
Yeah, she would drop me off and come back later on. And I think she was lucky with my sister because my sister, the one I mentioned from Madagascar, she came a few years after me. And my sister, in a way, she was lucky in that sense because Madagascar is a very diverse community. So a lot of people look Malaysian because Malagasy, Malay, it's from the same origin. So a lot of South Asian people moved to Madagascar, and so it's a mix of Indonesian, Malaysian, and Africans in the island. So my sister is more from the Asian side, so her hair is very curly. It's a lot straighter than mine, so she didn't have to go through all the struggle I had with my hair. So she was a lot more. She could identify with a lot more. She could have a white hair, really, in that sense. So she didn't have to go through. She hardly had the hair braided, actually. So she didn't have to go through that.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. And then you go to the UK, and were there more options then, at least, and between you doing yourself or at least being able to find somebody to do it for you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The UK was, I mean, it's interesting because I could see the diversity, but at the same time, it was hard to adjust because I've then been raised into this white environment. And then I go to the UK, and it's also a very different culture because in the UK, it's a lot of Caribbean people. So I was then surrounded by people with, again, very different culture from African and Caribbean are very different. So I was happy to be in the middle of people who look like me. It was still a struggle because I didn't feel like I was fitting in because I didn't understand or know about their own culture. So that was again another learning point and having to learn to be black in a way, really. I mean, even today, so it's even like when I went back to Madagascar in 2010. I could see that I was so westernized, and the way they could spot from a mile away that I wasn't living on the islands because they even knew I was a tourist. So things like that, it's he knows that he haven't been in this island for this long, and even though you've got the color, some part of you is no longer what other people in the islands live every day. So it's again another learning point, and yeah, you have to adjust all the time, and I think that the issue, one issue adopters has to do, because no matter where you go, and I think that's where the belonging issue come from, because we never know where we fit in or where we belong, because we have to constantly adapt to situation. So it's very difficult to really feel at home in a way. And when people ask me where is home, I always say France, but it's I only lived there 8 years, and it's an interesting answer, because and if people ask me, "Oh, would you move back to France now?" I'd say no. It's really interesting. I think at heart I'm definitely, Africa feels home, but in terms of practicality, I don't really know where I would say home, because I've moved around so much in Europe. So
Well,
it's, yeah,
that's
it's an interesting question.
yeah, because something as simple as a basic get to know you question, where are you from? You're not about to unload, well, this is where I grew up and then I was adopted here because but they are both home. And so the conflict of just answering such a simple question is not something that everybody has to deal with, but international adoptees are dealing with it constantly.
Yeah, I still don't know the answer.
Yes.
And I think it's interesting, because having a daughter now, she can feel some of the those nuances, because I've moved so much in my life that she also doesn't feel like the specific place. I mean, she lived most of her life in the UK, but we've moved so much in the UK as well in that time that she doesn't even feel like she has a specific place she could call home. And that has been, for me, it was a bit sad to know that, because we are so devoted, uprooted for so many times in our life that I think subconsciously that's why I continue to move a lot in my life, because still looking for that place where I'm gonna feel I belong. And I don't know if people ever find it.
It's
But
kind
yeah,
of
it's
it sounds like it's a place that you have to create instead of a place that's made for you, because like Madagascar is home because you were born there, and then another home is chosen for you. You didn't get to choose France, and then the rest of your adulthood is where am I choosing to be? And it's a lot of exploration because you've lived the range of the feeling very comfortable to feeling very uncomfortable.
yeah, and I think I stayed in the UK the longest, only because my daughter was born there and I didn't want to move her out of the place she was born, because I went through that. And it's an interesting thing to think about now, because it wasn't automatically a place I would say, if you ask me, "Oh, would you live in the UK this long?" I would be like, "No way." But this is the place I live the most. But because of the experience I've had before, so that's kind of impacted how I couldn't see myself removing my daughter away from her dad and live from a different country until she was old enough to live by herself.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, let's talk a little bit about your coaching experience. So you help adoptees. I guess you should explain it. You explained it a little bit at the beginning, but I won't put words in your mouth of like me attempting to explain it because you say it so beautifully.
Yeah, so the supporting is really around how they deal with their adoption journey or their own identity. So even before coaching, I was doing a lot of work around identity, and I focus on Black adoptees, because a lot of the work I did before I came into coaching was working with Caribbean and African communities. So I felt that I had that lived experience and I could support people in terms of their identity in that area. So with the adoptees, it's really looking, because sometimes we are stuck in our adoption story and we use that as who we are, but actually we don't have to be carrying that, whatever that story was imposed on us. So it's trying to support those adoptees to form their own identity. And that could be, the adoption story could still be a big part of their identity. But if that is keeping them stuck, then they need to find ways to accept the situation and then build a new identity of who they really want to be in the future. So it's supporting them in that process and how they can move from where they are now and who they want to be in the future. So that's kind of the journey I take them through.
That's such important work to have someone like you who's experienced it and can offer perspective and then help them make something new. And with the art and the fashion design that you do, I'm sure that does that come into it at all of like of using art in your coaching?
I've not used it so much in the coaching, but I'm doing a retreat, so that's something I want to bring in. So I've done a lot of exhibition around African history, so I am bringing those into my retreat. So I'm bringing the exhibition that I did a few years ago on African queens to the retreat for the women to identify and then do a workshop around that. So for them to explore their own heritage and see if there is anything in their heritage that they would like to explore further. So, for example, if they came from Africa and there is an African, historical African queen they want to learn more about, then they can do the research and we do some sharing about each one's heritage.
That's
So
very cool.
I am trying to bring it, and also the film. My dream is really to, part of it is going back to Madagascar with my daughter and document my adoption story. So I wanted to do that with a film crew at some point. So hopefully that will happen next time I go back to Madagascar. But I also want to do like a short documentary about people being displaced from their own country and how that impacts their identity.
That's amazing. We are here to support all of it because it just that sounds like that's such important work to see represented. I'm sure it would be very healing for an adoptee who's experienced this displacement and not being able to find home to see someone else's journey. You know, I'm not alone in all of this. Someone else is feeling the way that I'm feeling and representing it in a considerate way. So with your coaching, what would you say is at the heart of the hopes or the desires of the adoptees that you coach? Like if you had to summarize the experiences you've had talking with them and just fill in the blank of like they just wish or they just want blank, like what's the thing that that they're missing that they really long for?
I think it's that sense of belonging and knowing who they are. So yeah, like I say, a lot of the work I do is around identity. So it's come back again who they are. And sometimes because of how complex adoption is, you can't really know your history. So that is where a lot of the work I do is about, okay, so you are where we are now. Who do you want to be, even if you don't know your past? Who do you want to be moving forward? What type of work do you want to do? Which area, what make you happy? I think sometimes it's also about little things like self-care. I think a lot of adoptees don't always have that into place. And they've put everybody else before them and they get to a place where they don't know who they are anymore because, they're the last person they think about. So starting with little things like self-care and getting a routine, giving tools about how they can take care of themselves to be able to move forward to the person they want to be, that identity that they want to become. moving forward.
What kind of communication do most of the adoptees you coach have with their parents? Like, would you say most of them grew up not really talking about or processing their adoption, or some of them did and they're still grappling with it? Like, are there any themes that you notice from that?
I think there's a mixture, definitely. I think people would come into, I mean, there's a fine line between therapy and coaching, and I think I mentioned that last time. So I don't do any therapy work. So I would say that therapy would look at all the trauma side of what they've been through in the past. And very often, I think if someone is not processed that part of their trauma, I cannot support them just with the coaching. So I would recommend them to work with a therapist first. And then when they're ready, they can come back to me and work on where they want to go. But a lot of the, I think a lot of the adoptees, when they come to coaching, is because they either don't have the connection with their adoptive parents, so they're feeling a bit stuck and lost. And definitely don't have the connection with their birth parents either. Or they might, some of them have had reunion, but actually the reunion didn't work out very well. So they're still feeling like they're isolated and don't have anywhere to turn to. So it's, yeah, it's a mixture, but I would say the majority is people not knowing where they are at, who they are, and they don't have the support in their immediate environment.
Is there like, I guess what would be your advice to parents adopting Black children of like acknowledging differences but also not do overdoing it? Because there's like, I would imagine there's kind of this balance between you're part of our family, we love you, we don't want to talk about how we are different from each other all the time, but we also don't want to wait until you're grappling with some really tough issues, and then you feel like you can't bring it up because we've never talked about it before. Do you have any advice on that?
Yeah, I think it's about communication and being open with the child and allow the child to lead. Because I think the child, each child is different. Some will be ready very early on, some won't be ready. So allowing the child to let you know when they're ready. So when they're ready, open up a little bit more and support that child to explore. But from, I think from early on, as soon as they can start talking with the child about their backgrounds, is better because that will give the child time to process it. I would also say that the parents should educate themselves no matter how much the child is ready to know, because you don't want to wait until the child is ready then to find out this information. At least you are prepared when the time is coming for you to provide that. And I think also if there is, you know, I'm thinking about like in the way I was raised, I didn't really have anything around the house reminding me of my culture. And I think if I had things around the house that reminded me of this, then I would be asking question a lot more to my parents about, oh, why have you got this? What does this represent? But because I didn't have anything around, I didn't feel like I could even open up the conversation about that. So I think having things to make this conversation easier with the child is also useful. Even, you know, books. I mean, even I remember, I mean, I with my daughter, even though she's not adopted, I had to make that specific effort because I think for a child of an adoptee is very difficult as well because they still feel the repercussion of their parent being adopted. So I had to make the specific choices that, you know, I had books about Madagascar when she was a baby. And, you know, she's a lot more interested about learning about Madagascar than she's learning about France, for example. So,
Interesting. Yeah.
and, you know, she's really keen about finding out even about the tradition in Madagascar, who my parents were, what how they were like, and She's got a lot of curiosity about that. And when I look at her, I'm like, oh, these are the things that I wish I had as a as an adoptee, to be able to have all this curiosity and being able to ask questions, even if they didn't have the answer. But I didn't feel like I had the space or anything to prompt me to ask those questions.
That is very interesting. I think that's such a good point because as I'm a foster parent and I feel like it's all on me to ask the right question in the right moment. If one of the kids is missing a biological family member, that it's all on me to respond appropriately, but it feels a lot more organic to also just have reminders around. So if they are curious, then like, oh, here's a picture, and it sparked a memory, or adoption books or foster care books, like using those as prompts. I like how you said that, to prompt them instead of trying to analyze every situation exactly right, and then hoping that you have a good enough question to ask to help them feel safe.
Yeah, and I think nowadays, like you mentioned earlier, but we've got the internet. We've got so much more resources nowadays that I don't think there's any excuse not to know. And all you have to do is just Google something. And you can print out a drawing for a child to color in, about their culture. It doesn't need to be a big thing, but just to wake up the child's curiosity. Take them to a museum. If they're from a different culture and there is an exhibition about their culture, take them there. And that would prompt again some question and for both of them to, the child and the parents to learn at the same time as well. And that is kind of, closing the bond as well at the same time. So that's important.
Yeah, I think the openness around adoption communication has also changed a lot because when, I mean, you've described and there wasn't a lot of communication happening within your family. And I think at the time when adoptions were happening, then it was not as open. I'm sure there was a lot of like, maybe don't have a lot of reminders of home around because maybe your child will see it and it will have a negative effect on them. They'll get sad instead of feeling like my parents care about where it came from and it reminds me of home. So there's this like they want to put a lid on the emotional processing, but now I think that lid's being taken off where we want to live with the reality a little bit more and be sensitive to how we talk about it.
Yeah, and I think you also help when the child is ready to find out a bit more about the past, because, or if something else happened, because nowadays we've got the internet. Like I say, it's a lot different. People are finding out their relatives on Facebook like never before. So, if you don't talk about that, and one day the child said, "Oh, I found my sister or whatever online," I mean, even for me, I didn't even have the internet, but my stepsister from Madagascar, I got a letter at around 14, 15 from my sister saying, "Here I am your sister." And my adoption was supposed to be a closed adoption. My parent didn't know how she found my address. So it was, I don't think my parents were prepared either how to deal with that. And I felt stuck as well, because part of me wanting to know her, but part of me, my family is saying, "Oh, be careful, we don't know who this is." So it's kind of having be prepared the day that something like that might happen. How are you going to react to this? How are you going to support the child moving forward? I think it's important to, and all those preparation before that could help to come to that moment.
Yeah, I agree. Is there anything else that you would want to bring up regarding international adoption, transracial adoption, anything that came to mind we haven't talked about yet?
Well, it's I mean, I don't know in the US, but in Europe, international adoption is being stopped more and more. So I don't know if it's the case in the US, But in, for example, in France, they stopped international adoption back in October last year. So, and it's the same for Ivory Coast, Mali, Ethiopia stopped about 8 years ago. So there's more and more, a lot of countries will stop it because there's a lot of issue behind it.
Oh, like human
It's
trafficking
not,
concerns.
yes,
That is how
exactly.
I, yeah.
I mean, in France last year, there's a big scandal for an adoption agency because all the adoptees from Mali came together and realized that actually the adoption was not as legal as it seems to be because they found their birth family and the birth family have said they never agreed for the adoption. So their family are still in Mali and alive, and they might have said, we're putting our child for a bit for you to support us. We come back to get the child, but the child would never come back. And I am not sure for mine, because I found out last year that my adoption took place within 3 months. And that is very unusual for an international adoption to be so quick.
Yeah.
So part of the reason I'm asking my parent a lot of questions at the moment is who signed my adoption? And I've been told by my half sister who contacted me when I was 14 that it was my father. But it's very strange because I never knew who my father was, and my mother never told me who my father is. So I don't know who signed this adoption paper. But apparently someone signed it and my mother wasn't around. So there's a lot of question around international adoption. And like I say, I don't know in the US, but in Europe, there's been a lot of the adoptees, the adult adoptees are coming together and making lots of noises and wanting international adoption to be stopped.
Very interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not aware of what's happening in the US regarding that, but very interested to read more about it because the Europe and the UK, all the countries are a lot closer together, so it can kind of like a ripple effect, whereas I'm not totally sure in the US yet. That's very interesting though.
Yeah, so watch the space.
Yeah, well, I'm really interested to hear how your journey goes to hopefully go back to Madagascar and find out a little bit more. Suddenly the idea of a documentary feels more urgent of your life, of really finding out what were the circumstances around it.
Yeah, and I actually found out recently, which again, when we talk about trauma, my parents didn't know anything about the trauma of my birth family, but I found out recently that the tribe I come from went for a genocide by the French in 1947. So we're talking about not that long ago,
Not that long.
but it's not in any history book, and it was taboo for the people in Madagascar to even talk about it because of the trauma that's created. And this is a tribe where I come from. So I know in 1947, that would have been my grandparents' generation. So when you talk about generational trauma, I won't be surprised if I carry some of those trauma that they carried because it's only 2 generations down. And I don't know how old my mother was at the time, but I would definitely. And that's also part of the reason I always believed, and I don't know this for sure, but I always believed when my mother left me in the Catholic missionary, my grandparents never came to see me. Because the first time my mother went to hospital, she left with my grandparents. So I don't know why she left me at the Catholic missionary the second time. But my grandparents never came to visit me at the Catholic missionary. But if you think about the history, if they went for that genocide, there's no way they're going to come and approach the white missionary and speak to them. So there is a lot of trauma and history behind a lot of the international adoption as well that people take for granted, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, well, and
And
equally interesting that your mom felt like comfortable enough to make that decision for her to approach the missionary, but then your grandparents to not feel comfortable doing that. There's a clear difference in that. that dynamic. And you have a biological brother, right? I think you mentioned he passed away in the last several years.
He did. He passed away in 2022, and that was again, I think that probably, created a lot of emotions that should come out, because when I went back in 2010, I didn't see him because he was working in a different city to where we used to live. So I didn't, and also because I don't speak the language. It's very difficult. This is another thing us as international adoptee have, because we don't speak the language anymore. We are relying on a translator, and we don't know who we are talking to. We haven't been in the country for over 10, 15 years, sometimes 20 years. So whoever you're talking about, you're not sure if that is your, biological family. And it's very common in when adoptees return to their country that people have this assumption that because you have been raised in the West, we've got all sorted out. So very often there's people who are, cheating the system and come forward to say, I am your family, when they're not, because they want something from you. So for me, it was very, I didn't really keep the contact very often, because part of the family that I met just wanted money from you, from me. And because I didn't see my brother and only speaking to him for the phone through a translator, I didn't feel a connection. And that was difficult, but at the same time, when he passed away in 2022, I felt like, oh, that's, I lost my chance to even find out a bit more, because he was the only person really I could ask about my mother. So I didn't have it, and I've lost that now. I mean, he's got a daughter who is now in Germany, but I don't know how much she knows about my mother. So it's a difficult in a sense, because we never know who we are in a sense, really, because even if you go back, and especially in Africa, like paperwork is not always, easy to find as in the West. So there's no guarantee that even if you go back, find people, that those people are 100% your biological family. So yeah, it's interesting.
So, with your brother, he's an older brother. Do you have any ideas why you were placed with the missionaries, but he remained in Madagascar? Was he with your
Because
grandparents and just a different life?
no, it's a different life. I think, in this country, very young, you go out and work. He's older than me. He's probably 5 years older than me. So I guess by 15, you are going out and work, and you run your own life in a way, because my mother was a single mother. So she had it to, I guess, him as being the oldest, had to be out there and work. So, and he was old enough to go to work, so he can look after himself in a way. Even though, if thinking about it, he was still a child, but because he was able to go and work, I guess that was good enough for him to stay. And like I say, it was a very strange thing, because my whole family was in the village. So for me, that's part of the question I always ask. Because when I went back in 2010, my uncle didn't even know what happened to me. He didn't know I was adopted. So
Wow.
this is where I don't understand those things that is missing, because the missionary didn't even ask my uncle to look after me or to be put for adoption. But when I speak to my adoptive parents, they were taught that my uncle didn't want to look after me. So there is these two conflicting stories that I keep getting. And I don't see why my uncle would lie to me and say he didn't know what happened to me. So it's difficult sometimes to swallow that, sometimes maybe the adoption was not as legal as it could be. But yeah, it's things you have to accept, I suppose, because otherwise you get stuck in that story. And that's what I'm trying to tell my clients, that you have to get past that story if you want to move on sometime. Otherwise it just hits you inside and it just becomes very difficult. So Yeah, so there's a lot of acceptance, forgiveness, self-forgiveness involved in the journey, and compassion. A lot of self-compassion, because you have to accept where you are.
Yeah, and you have to create that yourself. It sounds like in a lot of ways, because no one person could fully understand everything you've experienced. So it takes a lot of intention, I would imagine, to choose a different story, or at least part, and then move forward with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think no matter what, I don't think anybody or well, any adopted can know 100% for sure whatever stories I've got is a real or the absolute truth, because there's so many people involved, there's so many documentation might be changed. So it's very difficult to really know for sure whatever you've got is the real story. So at some point, I think everybody have to make accept whatever they've got is what they have, and take what you can take out of that and move on if you can. I know some people can't, but it's a journey in itself.
Yeah, and if they're talking to you, then they're at least trying, and they know there's more work they have to do than, like you said, having a therapist and a coach to work with the past and then intentionally creating a new future sounds like really important work.
Yeah, and I think I'm still it. Even though I'm doing this work, I always tell my client that I'm also in this process, because I never know how the next information I get, how I'm gonna react to that. It's always changing. Today I'm okay, but when I found out that my adoption was not legal, how would I react to that? Those are the questions that I don't know until I see the information for sure. And I might have a breakdown. I might not. I don't know until the moment comes. So it's a journey in itself. And I think, all of us are moving to a different degree every day, about learning who we are and how to cope with it.
I'm hoping and wishing all the best on your journey. I hope the answers come and that there is a, if you find a way to document it, how meaningful it would be. I know that I would love to see the outcome. So long-term project
Thank
that I'm
you.
very, very excited about.
Thank you. And thank you for having me again.
Yes, of course. It's such a pleasure to talk with you. And we talked about a lot of topics. I think international adoption, transracial adoption, you're a wealth of information, and really appreciate you sharing your life and your insights.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so very much for listening to this episode of the Open Adoption Project, and a big thank you to Christelle for sharing your story and teaching and helping us to learn and grow. We are always so grateful for adoptees who share their experiences and perspectives. It really is so impactful and makes a big difference. So big thank you, Christelle. We really appreciate you. And also thank you, Alicia.
Yeah, I really liked this episode, and there are a lot of things that they dove into, but the one that's kind of just sticking with me is, Christelle has still a lot of unanswered questions about her experience, and there's the possibility that she'll never have some of those answers.
It's
And
heartbreaking, yeah.
it is really, really hard. And for me, that just makes me like doubly like invested in making sure that I can provide our children as much information as possible and go the extra mile to uncover or find extra information or more connections so that they will always have that.
Absolutely. And sometimes that's not possible, which is hard too. But I feel like that's where this other kind of openness that we've talked about in the past comes in, where you have these open dialogues and still have that door open to talk about feelings and emotions and about how it's hard to not have all the answers and the information, right?
Yeah, and it sounded like as a child for her, that really wasn't any of the conversation. Sounds like her mom was really busy raising other children and her dad working, and there's a lot of things going on in people's lives, and I think that that's another takeaway for me too.
Yeah, those conversations really are so important. Openness is important, and yeah, if you can't have an open adoption structurally, have an open dialogue.
For sure.
Yep. All right. Well, thank you so much again for listening to this episode. Just a quick little shout out. We have recently published the Openness Guide for Adoptive Parents, What You Should Know About Open Adoption. And we're really proud of it. So you can find that on our website, openadoptionproject.org, and find all the information about how to purchase that.
We also have it linked in our bio on Instagram at Open Adoption Project on Instagram.
That's right. And for a couple more days up through this Thursday, April
18th,
you can get 25% off with the code LAUNCHOAP.
That's LAUNCHOAP.
All right. So if that's something that you're interested in that might help you, then we wrote it hoping that it would help others in their journeys. It's really what we wish we had had when we were adopting the first time. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here, friends, and we'll be back soon.